This episode is sponsored by Interactive Brokers. I want you to discover the future of trading with IBKR Desktop, Interactive Brokers' next-generation trading platform. Built from the ground up, IBKR Desktop combines their powerful features with a unique set of groundbreaking trading tools in a streamlined, intuitive interface. With access to over 150 markets, IBKR Desktop puts global stocks, options, futures, currencies, bonds, and funds at your fingertips. IBKR Desktop includes innovative features like multi-sort, which lets you sort data using multiple factors simultaneously, helping you quickly identify trading opportunities. And they have the options lattice, which visually highlights key metrics for smarter decisions. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just starting out, IBKR Desktop redefines what traders can expect from a trading platform. Experience the future of trading today. And whether you're located in the US, Australia, or even Germany, you'll be amazed with the power of IBKR Desktop. Download IBKR Desktop at ibkr.com/desktop. Interactive Brokers is a member of SIPC.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
We got a herky-jerky market action continuing as Powell puts down the gavel. Tariffs are entering the picture once again. And our guest this week, Steve Selengut, talking retirement money secrets, all this and much more on episode number 865 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Hello, welcome to this week's episode of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Andrew Horowitz here in the studio at the offices of Horowitz Company inside of the great town of Fort Lauderdale within the state of Florida in the great country of the United States. So thank you for being here and joining me this week and every week. And what a week, what a month. Everybody thought things were smooth sailing and things were going to be just peachy. And man, we have what is in the making of a corrective action in the markets right now. I'm going to talk about that a little bit and what some of the things that we did and are doing for clients and what things you should be thinking about, because right now is not one of those times when you look at all the different headwinds that are going on to be, you know, I think super bullish. You can be, you know, invested, no question about that, but on margin, leveraged up on this kind of market, not really. Got to be careful right now, because what we're seeing is a lot of people deciding that there are too many things that are going on around the world that are concerning them, and they think that maybe valuations are stretched in some areas and need to be relaxed a bit. And what we had this week was, once again, the onslaught of Fed speakers giving us all sorts of great information for us to chew on as investors, but really mucking up the waters, in my opinion. Once again, they've gone from, and I'll go back to their confidence in their transitory inflation numbers. And this just one example. There's probably 50 of the same kind of cavalier attitude that the Fed speakers have, that they feel they know and understand what's happening, but have no ability to really read the tea leaves when it comes to the economy. They have no crystal ball, let's just put it that way, even though they come off as experts in the field. The fact is that when we look at the economy, it is something of a gigantic mess that trying to untangle and understand is very difficult. And while we use, and it's a good thing to do, trend lines and look at past occurrences and comparatives, seasonality, all those things are really good, but it's very difficult as a person that makes their living trying to predict, just as difficult it is as predicting the weather. And what they've done here is turned around and said, you know, the storm isn't coming. Everything is fine. In fact, it's so good. Just go outside. No umbrellas needed. And very little suntan lotion as well, because, you know, the sun's going to be strong, but not too bad. When in fact, now they're telling you, you know what? Maybe you need to get some umbrellas out in a hurry. All of a sudden, the chances, the likelihood of a cut, which was absurd to begin with at the beginning of the year, seven cuts, about 1.75 to 2% cuts in rates were predicted at the beginning of the year. Absurd, idiotic, nonsense. We talked about this again, if not once, 50 times. And then it was down to three, and maybe now down to zero. We saw Raphael Bostic and Powell and pretty much, I'm trying to think, was it pretty much everybody that was speaking over the week or so say that, you know what? We're not going to have rate cuts probably this year. And even one party was hinting there could be rate hikes. And what is happening there is, on the heels, particularly of Powell's commentary earlier in the week, we have a correction that's informing, is forming. And although our key reversal index signaled a bottom on Thursday morning, or at least a making of a bottom on Thursday morning, but let me just tell you something. Bottoming is a process. And with all the signals we're seeing, including the walkbacks on rate cuts, the issues in Israel, the issues with oil, the concern about the dollar, the spike in rates, it's a problem. Now, midweek, we saw some buying come in, maybe a relief rally part of the days, and then beaten down again. April's not so good. Look, we saw that from top to bottom so far, the Russell 2000 is down about 8% for the month. The Dow, because the top was pretty much of this year, and right at March 31st. Then we have the Dow, the S&P, the NASDAQ, 5%, 4%, 4%, down for the month. So that magical 5% number, all of a sudden, just in 2 weeks, 2.5 weeks, where are we? We're at midline of the month right here, right? I mean, we're talking about 20 trading days or so. Not 20 days. It's only about 12 trading days, 14 trading days in total probably for this month so far. And what we're seeing is that there is a significant amount of selling. And if I recall that we had, I think we had, it was some similarities to last year. I remember last year we had a strong start to the year, and then all of a sudden there was a drop off. And then there was concern that we're going to go back into a full-blown recession. Then we had the excitement over AI that started up. End of year with the, there was a beginning of it with the, move to lower rates, and that all just set everything on fire. Right. And then the same things kind of happened. In fact, it was October 12th, a couple of years ago. It was like October 14th last year. And there was some hiccups. There was some things, there was some drops and all, but basically right now rates are the issue. The move from 4.5% to above technical resistance on Monday after Iran rained down drones and missiles on Israel, which was fascinating because usually what you'd see was an inverse reaction and a safety trade. But no, that didn't happen. In fact, not only didn't it happen, it went haywire. It went wacko from 4.5% to as high as 4.69% that day on the 10-year bond. And now what we're seeing is more technical issues that are really starting to show up, where there's a gap fill potential to 4.8% in relatively short order because of the strength of this move. The predication of how fast something can move is the recent move, and this move has been moving. That's all very technical jargon there. The move is moving. But if you look at the trajectory and the speed, the skew of how fast things are moving right now, there is a really good chance that we could break above the resistance on the 10-year, and that would cause a bit of a problem. So what we did here is recently, the very recent moves versus what we've done already, because a lot of things we've done already in anticipation of this for our Investology portfolios. If you haven't gotten on that train, you should check it out. Minimum $10,000 investment, and it's pretty cool stuff. Just go to Investology with an E, Envestology. Our managed growth strategy, which I'm going to tell you about in a moment, what we actually did there, and our global allocation, some things we did the last few months. Much higher minimum for those, but if you want a diversified portfolio, that's where you look for that. The TDIMG strategy, what we have, our trading strategy, our equity core, primarily core, some hedging. So here's what we did just midweek last week, throughout the week and midweek, I should say. So what we did was we took down positions that had a real nice run of late. We said, you know what? Look at the valuations. Look where we are right now. Look what's happening in the market. These are holding up really well. They've done really well. In short order, let's take some of those down. Some we took down totally. We took down our XLE position. Nice profit. We took down some partial. But the fact is, you know, what we're talking about here is generalities, right? We wanted to actually add some short hedges on the portfolio as well. So we added a short hedge on the S&P 500 midweek. So that was kind of something that we're looking at just as precautionary, just as something that we want to have on short term, as we're seeing some strong numbers in the economy and markets are on edge. And now one of the core reasons to be ultra long, one of the legs of the table, if you will, has been kicked out, which is lower rates, been totally busted. So that being the case and all the things that are surrounding this, remember, the Fed was the safety net. The Fed was the place that we were going to look towards when, and in fact, there was trouble around the world. They were going to be saying, oh, you know what? We can always reduce rates. We have a lot of scope and flexibility. And now all of a sudden, they're saying something much different. That being the case, we have to make some different things happen in the portfolio. So that's just an idea. I'm not going to give you all the details here because it would be out of context. But basically, what we've done is, bottom line, reduced down some equity positioning, added some short hedges, and made sure that our any bond exposure in our other portfolios are short-term, short maturity, maybe inching out into the intermediate, but not much in that. So with that, we're going to have a guest on in a moment. I want to talk to you for a moment about Interactive Brokers again, because Interactive Brokers, well, it's the professional's gateway to the world's markets. Interactive Brokers offers commissions starting at USD, check this, at zero on U.S. listed stocks and ETFs, with low commissions on other products. And there are no added spreads, ticket charges, or account minimums. Clients in over 200 countries and territories can trade stocks, options, futures, currencies, bonds, funds, and more on 150 global markets from a single unified platform. Clients also earn interest rates of up to 4.83% USD on instantly available cash, and pay margin rates up to 49% lower than the industry. And you can earn extra income on your lendable shares. And IBKR's powerful award-winning trading platforms help every level investor succeed, from beginner to advanced, on mobile, web, and desktop. Learn more at IBKR.com. And our guest today is Steve Selengut. He's a 40-plus year professional investment manager, advisor. He's an RIA. His current adventure is coaching both individuals and other advisors in creating income independence for themselves and their clients. And he's right now involved in the, I guess we'll call it the roadshow, of promoting his second book called Retirement Money Secrets. And he's been a private investment manager for four decades, and he's personally managed hundreds and hundreds of individual portfolios. So we have some really good things. One of the things I want to start off with is, hello, by the way, how are you, Steve?
Good. How's it going?
Good. You got to kind of sometimes rein me in a little bit, you know?
Yeah. Well, you know, we were talking before, so I forgot all about that. Hello, Andrew.
Yeah.
Nice to meet you.
Yeah. So, you got a great name in there, Retirement Money Secrets. What do you mean? What secrets are there left? I mean, I don't want to, we'll go through all the list, but like, kind of give me broad-based concept here.
Well, you're going to be surprised. I'm an income investor. I focus on income investing, and I do it just as much and just as easily with the equity markets as I do with the fixed income markets. You know, I can generate income from anywhere. My secrets are really the type of security I use to accomplish this income program, to get income independence, is one of the secrets. And it's ironic that it's a secret, because it's the oldest form of fund in the marketplace.
Oh.
But closed-end funds. Have you ever heard of them?
Of course.
Okay. You're better than most. There are brokers, bank managers, all kinds of people, professionals who haven't heard of them.
Really?
Which is amazing.
That's pretty wild. They were really the precursor to ETFs.
Oh, they were 140 years before ETFs.
No, I know that. But from design standpoint, with how kind of a traded on right. an open market throughout the day
right.
and all that, yeah.
They are for that aspect yeah. of it, except ETFs are not pass-through trusts.
Right.
While closed-end funds are, which makes them the income production machines mm-hmm. that they are.
Right.
The difference also is that they're not designed to grow in market value. And that blows a lot of professionals' minds because they're paid on market value, not on income production.
Right.
So it sort of runs afoul of what they're really in there for, what mm-hmm. they're doing. But for my purposes and my clients, it was always, you know, that was the best thing. They could sleep nights. They didn't really care if the market went down. They knew if it went up, I'd be taking profits. They knew if it went down, I'd just be reinvesting and for future profits. And with closed-end funds, particularly when you have quality and income and diversification standards in place, you're dealing with funds that have been around for an average of over 25 years. Mm-hmm. You know, they have literally an average of over 100 or more, maybe 200 or more positions inside. You know, so you've really got a well-diversified income machine, and I trade it. And when you do that, then you develop a whole second stream of income. So I've got the base income coming in, and I've got the capital gains coming in. So even this year, which has been an up and down year, it's been okay. In the bond market, it's pretty much been terrible because interest rates stopped going down, which has cost something. But I've taken, you know, more than 2 months worth of additional income in the form of capital gains on top of the regular income coming in.
Mm.
And that's a good sign for a good year. You know, I make about half as much in capital gains as I do in base income.
Well, that would make sense.
But this year would be better. Most portfolio managers don't take profits unless the client tells them to.
Mm-hmm.
When I was first doing it, some of our compliance people that came out to audit would always say, why are you taking profits? Why'd you sell that? It's going to keep going up, they say, or it's gone up since you sold it.
Oh yeah.
So I say, well, what's your point? Well, somebody could sue us.
Yeah. Don't do anything. Don't do anything. It's better.
Yeah. If you don't, you know, yeah. If you sell something, yeah, you can have a lawsuit, but not if you've already told your clients that's what you're going to do. And you put it in writing
mm-hmm.
and they've signed off on it. That's yep. my job.
Sure.
If I don't take profits, I'm going to get sued, you know? So then, you know, so it was hard for a lot of those types of people and for the people, even the ones that we sold our business to accept that, you know, the money machine isn't something they particularly had any use for. They wanted that AUM because they planned on putting their company on the block in a few years after they'd bought up all these other companies. Then they had a big, big book of business,
yep.
right?
Yep.
Then they were going to sell it maybe to Fidel. Who knows who they would sell it to?
Mm.
But they didn't really care that right. we made more money for our clients than most people.
That's a shame.
Could.
That's a shame. That's terrible. That's the, you know, isn't that the definition of a fiduciary relationship, putting the client first?
Well, most clients think that growth in market value is their best interest.
Well, it's growth of portfolio value.
Yeah.
You know, portfolio. However you want to look at it, you want to look at it yeah. from, if is. Let me ask you this question. I mean, there's some tax implications in this, but is 10% right. growth and 10% income, what's the difference?
Everything. You know, if your portfolio goes up 10%, your income doesn't change.
Yeah.
But if you take that 10% and you turn it into more capital to produce 10%, then you've got a difference going forward. Our goal was always to raise both the income and the working capital. And I can define working capital if you want, every quarter and every year. And if And if the market value of a portfolio ever got to be larger than the working capital total, then we knew we weren't taking our profits as we should be.
And how do you define that?
Working capital is the cost basis of all the securities and cash in the portfolio.
Okay. So what you invested in at my level of investment.
Right. Well, yeah, your initial investment is the first lump of capital.
Right.
It, you add to it any dividends or interest received and any realized capital gains. So the capital itself grows, regardless of whether that market value went up or down in that period of time, the base, the capital still grows. Okay. Mm-hmm. The only way working capital goes down is if you take losses or if you remove money, if you withdraw money.
So now I want to talk to you. I don't want to forget about this because it keeps on coming up in my head. I should probably put it down to paper real quick, but I want to talk about closed-in fund discounts and premiums, but hold that for 1 second. Let's just remember to talk about that. But is this process retirement money secrets? Does that mean both sides of retirement getting to and then also partaking in?
Sure. The more you use those, the approach in the secrets book, the more income you'll have when you retire. I started using this approach, believe it or not, back in the 70s. When I was 25, I got what was left of my college fund and all the money I had put away as a kid when I was driving trucks and lumber yards and teaching people how to water ski and mowing lawns, all that stuff that I gave my dad to invest for me because he insisted that I do that. Mm-hmm. you know, he left me enough to put gas in the boat, you know, that's about how. And when at 25, that all came back to me in the form of a whole slew of stock certificates, something that we don't see anymore. But I had probably every company in the Dow Jones 40 at that time, and a few others, and they were all dividend payers and everything. And I had instantly got focused on income. And then my father was in the real estate business, and he had rental properties and stuff like that. And he'd be collecting the rentals, but he'd also be selling them and buying more and selling them and buying other ones and so forth. And he explained to me, you know, that there are several streams of income that I have going in my operation. Mm-hmm. You know, I've got the rents, I've got the sales profits, I've got the profits from the lumber yard, which also helps me build the houses cheaper. So my profit margin there is better. I insure these things. I take back the mortgage. I mean, he had a vertically integrated dynamic business back in the 60s.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And that's where I learned about all this stuff. So I said, what I'm going to do is I'm going to make enough income from this portfolio safely to, you know, kiss my job goodbye and become an investment manager.
Right.
And I did it. By the time I was in 79, I was making about five times my salary. Wow. Admittedly, it was a lousy salary. It was a lousy company. But it wasn't a lot of money, but five times it was a lot of money.
Yeah, yeah.
And I left there. Two of my buddies, I leaned on them real hard to let me do what I showed them my portfolio. This is where it was 7-8 years ago. This is where it is now. Let me do that for you. They signed up, and the rest is history.
Wow!
You know,
I've always been there. Let's go into that question that was just I laid out there. When you're working with closed end funds, and we deal with this issue that I've looked at a lot, and we've seen this wide disparity sometimes in levels of differential between NAV and value of the portfolio, known as a discount or premium.
Right. So there's two things you're looking at. NAV is one thing. NAV is the value of the securities inside the portfolio. And let's say they're all treasury bills, for argument, or all corporate bonds. When interest rates go up, the value of those goes down, but the amount of money they produce does not change at all, right?
Yep.
They keep paying the income. So the only thing that's happening is net asset value is changing as a result of, it's almost like the scales of justice. There's nothing you can do about it. If interest rates go up, the prices go down, period. End of story. And that's what you're seeing today. That's what you're seeing since interest rates started to go up. You're seeing this change in the NAV downward because these bonds can do nothing but go down.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Right. The other side of the coin is the price of the security. The price of security is simply supply and demand. There's no intended relationship in a closed-end fund between the price and the NAV. It's not like an ETF or a mutual fund where at the end of every trading day, they manipulate the number of shares so that when you divide the one by the net asset value or multiply it, the price by the number of shares, you equal the net asset value. And they do that every night.
Well, they do it because there's a constant relationship between price and net value. But the difference is also they have a unlimited amount of shares being either retired or issued, whereas a closed end fund, which says closed end, which I think the word closed is important versus open end, right? A normal mutual fund is considered that quote unquote normal mutual fund is considered open end, where the closed end, there is a limited and exact number of shares, period, end of sentence.
Precisely. And the only way they can change that I've seen is by rights offerings, which very few of them actually do. And I've only known of one that's ever issued in every dividend. It was giving a portion of the dividend in stock.
It's like a principal flowback.
Yeah, like that. There also is return of capital, but that can come from many sources. I mean, if I owned a closed-end fund and it gave me return of capital and I gave it to my shareholders, it's going to be return of capital too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's a non-taxable $1 for dollar, and it reduces the cost basis.
Right.
So it's a wash.
Right.
But the
so why do you think that most investors don't know about this? Is it the Wall Street machine that has no real ability to capitalize on the fees or something, or what is it?
I think it's got a lot to do with the fact that, you know, they don't grow. I mean, they have to pay out 95% of their earnings to their shareholders. So it's very difficult to grow a business on that basis. What if Amazon had to pay out 95% of its earnings?
Right.
Or even 50%. It wouldn't be the size it is today.
But a mutual fund, an open-end mutual fund does.
Does what?
Has to pay out all of its earnings.
It doesn't pay out all of the earnings.
No, but it pays out something like 89 or 90. There's some number, the same kind of thing with an open-end mutual fund that requires them to pass through, not pay out, pass through.
They have to add securities. They can't have balances of cash. So if we have a bull rally and people keep buying a mutual fund, they have to keep buying securities, whether they think it's smart or not.
Right.
They don't have a choice. With the case of a closed-end fund, the manager says, "Hey, I'm not buying it at this price," you know,
right?
And it doesn't matter. So, so back to the question: since they don't tend to go up, in price, and because they're so interest rate sensitive, I mean, there's only a couple sectors of the stock market that are really interest rate sensitive, and those are what, utility stocks and bank stocks, maybe,
and real estate.
And real estate.
Yeah.
But everything, even the equity side, is interest rate sensitive in a closed end fund.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so they're not going to go up in price. They're not going to, your AUM is not going to go up except in a year like 2021, where everything goes up,
right?
You know?
Yeah.
So even this year, when we've just had all time highs up until a week or so ago.
Right.
But interest rates weren't going down. So the fixed income market has not gone up.
So, you know, you talk about market cycle investment management. Market cycle investment management is acronym MCIM. I'm making that up. Tell me about what does that mean?
It's not made up. It was in my first book.
No, I'm not picking up. Okay, here you go. Well,
you know, yeah, market cycle. Yeah. What that means is that you understand. You understand. If you look at any chart, any long-term chart, you'll see that the market has always gone in waves. If you really dissect it, sectors move in waves. Overall, there's an upward bias on that cyclical movement. But the cyclical movement is there. Right now in the equity markets, we're just below an all-time high in the market cycle, but we're really only 2% above where we were in 2021. But we're still, the prices are still relatively high in the equities. And if you looked at the five years, which I do now in closed-end funds rather than 1 year, I mean, we're in, particularly in the income sector, we're way, way, way below where we were 5 years ago when interest rates were near zero.
Yeah, I mean,
so
that,
that cycle, we're at the bottom at. So you use that cycle. Okay, if I'm buying income portfolios, I'm saying to myself, I'm still at the bottom of the cycle. It's somewhat more likely if interest rates are going to move at all, they're going to move down and not up. So if my thinking is that, I can say, all right, it's safer for me to buy more of what I'm buying now in the income area than it would be to buy more equities because they're closer. You know, they're at their 1 year high close and they're closing in on their 5 year high. Some of them are already there. And I'll make a list of closed end CEFs that are at their 5 year high and I won't buy as much of them. So the management aspect is if you know you're in an upward trend like in 2021, right? You'd still want to be in the market because interest rates were zero and there's no money market funds. So when you took your profits, you definitely wanted to reinvest. So instead of taking a 2% position as an initial investment in a security, I take a 1% position because my gut tells me eventually the market's going to go down, right? So that's what I do. If the market's down, I'll take a little larger position because it's more likely that I'll be taking a profit than having to add to this position.
You know, it's interesting because you talk about how this is a total difference than a momentum trader. And let me just take you through what my thought is on this for a second. You mentioned that, and we've had plenty of momentum traders and people that are in that area, whether it's trend following, whether it's momentum, whether it's, you want to call it, you know, just, you know, keeping up with the technical analysis and all. But one of the things you said was when you see that they're on all-time highs or closing in on that, maybe you'll buy less of those, which makes me think you're a bit more of a contrarian investor looking for the other side, that they're going to come back and we're going to see a reflexive trade on the other side. Very different than a momentum trader that is actually going after, in fact, chasing the run-up, which we can't argue that there are some people that are very good at that, right? There are people that are good at the whole area of investing that way.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure there are. I think for the average guy to try to predict stuff like that, I think it's foolishness, really. I'm not a technical guy. I've never used technical analysis. Even when I was starting out and I was all in individual stocks, it was always fundamentals for me. P/E ratios, debt-to-equity ratios, profitability, how long, raising dividends. Does he pay a dividend? If he doesn't, I'm not interested, you know?
Right.
That's just a matter of respect, I think.
Well, it's interesting because I find there's a lot of use in both sides. I find that there's a lot of use in the fundamentals, but there's nothing to be said that a great company can't get caught up in a stock market jam, right? You know that it's like having a great car doesn't mean that it just can't get into a bad accident.
Exactly.
Whereas a technical analysis sometimes can keep you on course. That's all I'm saying.
Like I said, I'm sure so many people do technical analysis. It's great. It's out there.
It's a great adjunct, is all I'm saying. I'm not trying to convince you.
I recognize it, and it's good for me.
Yeah.
It's good for me because it pushes things up, and I own securities that own everything else.
Right.
So if the tech guys are pushing up that stock market. That's great for me.
Yeah.
I'm going to take profits. I'm going to buy more equity close-end funds and so on. I'm as happy as a pig, and you know, when that happens too. So I love it that there's so much diversity in the way people approach the market.
Yeah.
I get scared when advisors will suggest to people that there's safety in stuff like commodities and futures and, you know, things like that. That worries me.
I don't know if the safety, this diversification, I like commodities for diversification.
I do too.
I don't think there's necessarily
safety. I'll buy a closed end fund that owns companies that have commodities.
Right.
I'll buy this one, you know, this one Gabelli closed end fund that specializes in gold.
Mm-hmm.
I've made a lot of money on it in inflation. You know, when inflation sends gold prices up, I've made a lot of money on it, and it pays me a 7 or 8% distribution.
Assuming are gold with Gabelli, it's going to be gold companies.
Yeah.
Mining companies, junior miners.
Right. Yeah. Right. So that's how I do commodities. That's how I do options.
Right.
There are closed end funds that do covered calls. I like covered calls, but I don't want to spend the time and have equities and have equities taken away or whatever.
Yeah.
All that work involved when I can own
all the mess. I just want to eat the food, right, man.
I just want to cook the
food. Just give me the food.
So the closed end fund manager does all that work.
Yeah.
And I take the gravy, you know. So I found this. I was an individual stock person for half my career, probably,
mm-hmm.
if maybe a little less.
Yeah.
I discovered I actually used some closed end funds for equities before I even knew what closed end funds were. Like, it was one called Petroleum and Resources. It's got a different name now. It's still PEO, but it used to pay this humongous distribution every December, and particularly when the energy sector back in the day, when all those takeovers were going on, mm-hmm. and stuff like that,
yeah.
It was amazing. You get $2 or $3 dividends in December compared with quarterlies of 10 cents.
Right.
So I started trading those instead of waiting for the dividend.
Right.
I would take the profit that I had just before the X date.
That's smart.
Because then I didn't have to buy it again until next September.
Right.
So today on my selection universes, I have a thing that I call the September group. So when I give that to my coaching clients, I say, this group you look at in September.
So what is the current, you mentioned yield a few different times, many times. What is approximately the average yield now on like the closed end universe that you're looking at?
Okay. I use three universes. I'll get you started, and this should mm-hmm. open the eyes. I have 45 closed end tax free funds in my tax free universe. The average yield is over 5%.
On tax free. Right.
And some of those are state tax free: California, New York, New Jersey, Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
The taxable income right now after this last downturn is just at 11%. And that's 100 different closed end funds.
Say that again though. Wait, what? The taxable side is 11% on average?
On average.
Well, what are they investing in though? That can't be just your normal everyday. That's got to be high yield bonds and things of like that.
There are some high yield bonds. There are also treasuries. There's also preferred stocks. There's also mortgages. It's incredible. I mean, if I sent you the universe and you looked them up, you'd see that the security, it's not all junk bonds,
right,
as you would say.
But how are they squeezing 11% out with rates that have come up so dramatically?
Well,
rates are only 5.5, 6%, 7%.
I know, but the income hasn't changed. And the way they do, initially, the way they do it is because instead of borrowing to build more factories or mm-hmm. borrowing to get more retail outlets or to open more offices, they use leverage just like a company would do to buy more securities.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So they'll, if they've collected $100 million from their initial public offering, they can borrow up to $50 million and buy more securities. So mm-hmm. the original investors are investing in a portfolio of $150 million instead of $100 million. But that's
but you don't find that being aggressive. You don't find that, you know, you mentioned things like commodities and things like that, but leverage is one of the evil sides of investing that could really sink you pretty hard.
It's evil if you use it as margin investing.
But that's what they're doing inside the fund, you're saying.
No, they're not doing margin investing. They're doing direct loans on, it's BlackRock, for God's sake. BlackRock could go out and borrow money from anybody.
I know that, but what I'm saying is that the portfolio they have, the $100 million, is really $150 million. The $100 million they raised, it bought $150 million worth of securities.
Bought $150 million.
That's a leverage, so therefore, that's why you're getting the excess return.
Right. Yeah. That's why you're getting the excess income.
Right. Which means you'll get the excess downside if something happens.
You'll get the market value may be a little bit more volatile, but that doesn't change the money
that
you're getting.
That doesn't change the income. I'll give you that.
Change the income.
Right. No, I got that. Yeah.
So what stable. It does, it creates opportunity to bump up your income, which is exactly what we have right now when they're 11 cents. When it was down 6%, when the interest rate was zero, as it was from 2010 to 2020.
Right.
No, yeah, that's all.
No, it was well, it was, we went back 12, and forth. We had 2008 for a while, it was zero, 2020.
Right.
We've had multiple times that we went to this once in a lifetime zero bullshit.
Yeah, I know, but it was, remember back in the day, you're a younger guy. I don't know if you would, but before the financial crisis, you never heard of 4% interest rates.
Right. No, I get that.
It was never that low.
Right.
I remember buying.
Eights was normal. That was like kind of the normal number.
I know. And I remember buying a New York Transit Authority municipal bond paying 12% once. It was incredible. Of course, it got called away from me as soon as Rich went.
Right.
But think about what these guys had. These guys have been around for those 20, 25 years. Mm-hmm. Okay. They were buying bonds back then that are still in their portfolios 20 years, 15 years later.
Right.
So they had this base, and then they were maturing, and then over time they had to replace those 8% bonds with 3% or 4% bonds during that last 12 years. Okay. So now what we have is the newer bonds, and if you're a smart manager, you're not going to buy a 30-year bond at 2.5%. You might buy a 5-year bond, right? Not a 30-year bond.
Mm-hmm.
But now those 2-year bonds and 1 years and the older ones of 12 or 15 are maturing. And now instead of getting 2%, they're getting a 5% or 6% or 8% or a high yield. Maybe they're getting 12.
Mm-hmm.
So their rates last month alone, Eaton Vance raised their dividends at every one of their equity closed end funds, everyone that I owned anyway. And that was 12 of them.
Wow.
Well, so far this year, there have been 52. I just did this on April 12th, so I know the numbers. I didn't just make this up.
Right.
There were 52 increases this year in closed-end fund distributions, monthly distributions, and only 8 reductions.
Wow.
And that's out of 240 funds.
Wow. Now, you mentioned something we should talk about, and something I kind of want to understand more about, because you pose the point that there's something wrong with a 4% annual draw rate for retirement portfolios. And maybe you can clarify that.
Yeah, I don't think there's I don't have a problem with the concept that a person is likely to need to draw 4% or could safely draw 4% from his portfolio every year. I think that's probably a pretty fair and good target. What I take exception with is that the professional community makes no effort at all to provide that 4% from income. And I always used to think that way. And now that I've been a coach and I've looked at roughly 120 different personal portfolios since I started coaching, it almost looks like they're purposely designed to produce as little income as possible.
But there's something to be said in the area of tax efficiency of a portfolio. Now, let me give you an example.
Okay.
There are some clients that are very tax sensitive, right? There's some that aren't. I mean, that's just the way it is, right? Some clients are Let's say you have a client or a person that has most of their money in IRAs. Well, who cares? We could talk about who cares. I'm just saying that the income versus the taxation of the money out is the taxation of the money out, right? Whenever you take out, it's taxable. It's different what happens inside the portfolio. Now, let's take the opposite extreme. Someone who has no retirement funds at all and is only invested in individual accounts, joint accounts with the spouse or whatever it is, right? Mm-hmm. Now, that account, if there is any tax sensitivity, you have to be aware of, at least I think so, of where you're getting your income from and what is the distributions. I can oftentimes set up a portfolio to have distributions from a combination of growth and income, reducing down the overall taxation of the output of the income. And that I do that purposely, for example.
Okay. I understand that. And I understand why some people are obsessed with the amount of taxes they pay. I've always had a smile on my face except this year, because I just sold my business and you can imagine what I paid in taxes. Mm-hmm. So, but typically I'm not all that unhappy with it because I like the idea that I'm making that much money. But I've been working lately with people with, you know, high seven figures, mm-hmm. and they're talking to me about this and their joint accounts, the interest sensitivity can easily be resolved with a portfolio that contains a couple $100,000 of tax exempt closed end funds yielding over 5%.
Right.
I mean, I have a guy I'm working with right now that his very large investment portfolio, we're going to have a seven figure tax free portion of the income portfolio. It's still going to be traded. Mm-hmm. And that's going to be very lucrative if interest rates go down, because those things go up like crazy when interest rates come down. Mm-hmm. Over my experience, that is no guarantees here. but the rest of the income portion of that personal portfolio is going to be taxable, and this guy's in whatever the maximum tax bracket is, he's in it. But the idea, and to me, is it's almost like another of the one of the captions on the cover of the book. If you've got, and this is about income or capital gains or anything, but if you're walking on the side of the road and there's $100 there, you're going to pick it up and you're going to take it, mm-hmm. even if it's taxable and you got to pay out 40 of it to the government. You're still $60 ahead.
Yeah, I understand that. I totally get it.
And that's the same thing with my feeling about the income portfolio, that the focus on income and the maximization of the capital gains stream of income is going to make you a happy camper income wise, even after taxes.
I guess the only thing is that I've been doing this a long time also, and I get it. It's just different strokes for different folks, how you get to the same place.
It's totally different. Different mindset.
That's all. And it doesn't mean necessarily one is better than the other. It's also what's best for that client.
Exactly.
That's all. I mean, it's simple as that. There's just different ways of getting to the same. You know, you could take three different roads. You know, you tell your phone, I want to go to this place. It gives you three different options. This one is 2 minutes longer. This one's a little bit faster right now. By the way, faster right now because there's traffic on the other one right now. You know, which one do you want to use? Get you to the same place within a reasonable same amount of time. So that's, I think, what we're talking about here. I don't think we're talking about major differences. It's just different tweaks of how it's done.
Well, yeah. Yes and no. I mean, the income focus itself is different.
I give you that.
And the focus on equities, people not taking their profits, then, you know, when you get a 2 month COVID downturn, which was almost as severe as the crash of 87 in percent, mm-hmm. and people panic and all of a sudden they take those losses instead of having taken their gains. You know, their profits have just turned negative and they think the world's coming to it. Back in 87, my cousin-in-law, I had his high six-figure portfolio, and in 87 he just couldn't see it. He said, no, Steve, it's not going to be, it's not going to be like it always is. This time is the real thing. We're going under. We're going under. I kept telling him, no, it's just, it could even be a computer loop for all we know, because it was the first time that we had those trading bots and stuff like that. And he said, no, I'm taking it all, taking all the cash I have right now. And he did. He sold everything. 18 months later, we were back at another all-time high.
It reminds me of a story. I had a friend of mine call me. I think it was during COVID, and things were not good. And he said, and he wasn't a client, and he said, you know, I'm thinking about taking my money out, but everybody I've been talking to says don't. And he said, I said, well, what do you want from me? He says, well, I want, you seem to have a real good pulse. Well, what he wanted from me was permission, by the way. Just as I give you the shortcut here. You have a real good pulse on what's going on. I listen to you. I hear you. You know, even though I don't work with you and all that, I've always admired, blah, blah, blah. He gives me this whole thing, right? And I said, okay. I said, here's the deal, my friend. I think you're probably right that it's a good idea maybe to cash out. If that's what you want to do for your sanity, for your family, for all this. However, you need to get back in. And how are you going to do that? When are you going to do that? If you don't have that plan, I don't mind you getting out. I don't mind you getting out. I really don't. But if you don't have a plan to get back in, you're going to screw yourself. And that's why most people just kind of hang on and say, I'll just ride it out, right? Because that's their plan, is to ride it out. If you say to me something like, this is what I'm going to do. If the market goes down from here another 25%, I'm going to show that as a bargain, not get concerned and nervous and think about maybe inching in and starting getting going. Or if, in fact, it doesn't go down, I mean, give yourself a couple of different parameters. If it doesn't go, but I don't know what he did in the end because I didn't want to. I said to him, that's the only way you could do this. And I'm not giving you a blessing either way, by the way. So, but that's the same thing you're talking about, is when, you know, people make a lot of mistakes at the wrong times.
Right, exactly. And that's why this, my profit taking discipline is quite a bit different from most advisors, really. I mean, right. And when I was doing individual equities, I had a 10% profit target.
Right.
And I was even back in the day when we were paying commissions on trades.
Oh boy.
So I'd have a 12%, basically I'd have a 12% target, right, you know, to get it. Because my cost basis included the commission, but it came out. So, but I've always done that, and I've never hesitated to reinvest regardless of which way, you know, the market was expected to go or anything, because I always tempered. If it was high, I wouldn't buy as much. If it was lower, I would, you know, that type of thing. So I sort of gave myself like, I'd never want to get as high as 5% in any of my clients' portfolios, a 5% position in any one individual holding. Mm-hmm. So the profit taking covered that.
Right.
But in getting back in, I had to give myself another leeway, I thought, for maybe averaging down at least twice and still not get to 5%. So that's how I would try to manage it through the cycle. You know, and if it went back up, I took the profit.
Right.
You know, right. And we start all over again, you know, that type of thing.
So
that's carried over into closed-end funds, but I don't have quite as high a goal because we're dealing with a portfolio of securities, which means you need a trend as opposed to just one.
Right. You know? So I have two, I want to ask one or the other, and you tell me which one you want to answer and go through. Okay.
Okay.
You want to talk about some of the principles of income-focused retirement investing, which we've been talking about, right?
Right.
Or some of the biggest mistakes investors make, which we kind of talked about also.
I think we could do either. I mean, I'm just looking at the big mistakes that I jotted down.
Okay, let's go through those. Let's do that.
And I guess, I would say I'll put them. They're really kind of conceptual. I'd say probably one of the biggest mistakes is that they go through their entire investment life with a market value only focus.
Okay, I understand.
They don't think about the need for income. Like somehow I was lucky. I got that message. I need the income.
Yeah.
You know, I'm buying the same securities everybody else is in different packages, and I'm thinking about the income, but they don't get that market value focus until it's too late. And then they're in a position like you were talking about, where they've got this $5 million individual portfolio, half of which is their company stock that they retired with. It's paying 1%. And the other stuff has got a half a million in profits there that, oh my God, I'm going to pay all these taxes if I want this portfolio to generate income. And I'm going to have to pay the taxes anyway, because I'm going to have to sell them to live on, you know? So if they have that market value focus, they had an income focus instead, they would get there. The taxes would already be paid, because they'd be paying them every year on the profits. In other words, they wouldn't have anything with a 60% profit left.
Yeah.
And they'd get in there. So that's the market value focus, I think, is a mistake that people make.
Okay.
Another one is almost related, but not really, is that, it's kind of ingrained because of a lot of things, and particularly in managed portfolios, that the profits aren't taken.
So,
you know,
it's kind of the same thing where the growth.
Yeah, they don't take the profits. They languish in them. They feel good about them, you know, especially if it's their own company that they love. I mean,
you can't deny that some people have bathed in their profits, like a Jeff Bezos as a crazy example, and that's what he's had, and why sell it until you need it?
Yeah, yeah, and you know, of course. But what happens if?
Right.
What happens if is always in the back of my mind.
Mm-hmm.
You remember Payne Stewart?
I do. Oh, he was a great golfer with he used to wear knickers.
Knickers, exactly. Yeah. Right. He was a Scot. The Scot was there.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
What if that was him? What if that was Peter Lynch instead of Payne Stewart in that jet?
Yep.
And it crashed into the side of a mountain. What would have happened to your Microsoft holdings?
Yeah, no, I've been, no.
You know what I mean? So you got, it's the what if. It's that's the diversification thing. And that's another of the mistakes they make. They fall in love. There's no love in the market.
Well, you I always say love is stock.
I sell out of love. I sell out of love.
So Steve, love a stock as long as it loves you.
There you go. But that, I think that'll get you in trouble.
Well, no. What do you mean?
I think it can get you in trouble.
Can get you in trouble. Yes, I'll give you that.
It can.
Of course.
But I don't really care. If it gets to my target, I'm out of there.
Yeah, I got you.
And every day of my investment life, I'm going to in my portfolio, which is substantial, I'm going to take at least three. My goal is to take three profits, the three top profits in each of my three accounts every day.
Really?
Every day. And they can be minimal profits, because what I'm doing with those minimal profits, and this is what I call the accelerator effect of profit taking in the Secrets book. When I take that profit, I'm releasing $12,000, $13,000 in capital that I can buy something new with. Maybe something that I sold at a profit a week ago, or I can add to multiple positions that are below the cost basis, so I can increase their yield and reduce their cost basis. Every time I do that, I'm accomplishing that. And in a rally type environment, a broad rally like 21, my top three profits could be 7%, 8%, and 9% in each of those accounts.
Well,
right now I'm lucky if they're 1%. Right. After this last little doodad.
Yeah.
And especially if that's your daily routine. But I've taken the equivalent, I think I said, of over two months worth of income and profits already this year.
Mm-hmm. That's great.
You know, so that's the accelerator tech that I subscribe to. So profit taking, more diversification, low income, of course, is right in there. They allow them, obsessed with taxes.
I mean,
controlling your taxes. I mean, you've got Roth IRAs, you've got IRAs, you've got things you can put 529s if you have children that you know you're going to be putting through college. You got places to put money that keeps you from paying a lot of taxes.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Take advantage of them. Yeah. Take advantage of them. Right. But I guess the last one is probably the fault of our educational system, as well as it is of the individual not taking the time to learn about investing or economics even.
And it is Financial Literacy Month. It is April.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Well, it's a good thing to have.
Yeah.
It should be 12 months a year.
Be 13 months a year.
I mean, you know as well as I that the average guy, the average woman is not financially savvy.
Well, that's why we do this whole thing. That's the whole point. It's the financial education and information
the education
that they can't get.
Piece. Yeah.
That's important.
So
we're going to wrap it, my friend, Steve Selengut. We have the information on how to get your book. And of course, you can find it in all great bookstores and all that. But over on the Disciplined Investor show notes, episode number 865, all the information
865.
Is 865. Wow. Been doing this since 2007.
Wow.
Yep. Longest running independent financial podcast, still running, continuously running. I think is the right word on that there.
That's great.
But thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Oh, it was a pleasure. It was a good conversation, I thought.
All right, great. Thanks so much. Bye-bye. Hey, and that wraps it up for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast, a different side of the investment universe, looking at income and closed-end funds as a different way to produce your long-term needs for money. Much different than we talk about a lot of times with the folks that talk about momentum, technical analysis, even hardcore fundamentals. Kind of a different thing. So I want to thank Steve for bringing that to us. Thank you so much for joining me again. I'll see you again next week. We have a great guest coming up, John Williams. And then on the list goes on and on and on with who we have coming up over the next several months. Kim Flynn and Michael Johnston. Then we got Jared Dillian. That's going to be kind of cool. Then we have Brad Baldwidge. It's all the way booked through July right now. Thanks for joining me. I'll see you again real soon. Nothing discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, the information presented is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice, or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training. Advertisements are not related to the host or affiliates and are not considered recommendations by the host of the show or any affiliates of Horowitz & Company.